Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Debbie Laskar, author of The Atlas of Reds and Blues, published by Counterpoint Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. We're so pleased to have Debbie here today with us, reading from her book, which is a lyrical, painful narrative that explores racism, police brutality, and isolation.
For those not familiar with Debbie's work, Debbie S. Laskar is the author of The Atlas of Reds and Blues, which is the winner of the 7th Annual Crook's Corner Book Prize 2020 for Best Debut Novel Set in the South, the 2020 Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, sponsored by the Asian Pacific American Librarians Association, a long-listed book for the 2019 Golden Poppy Award, sponsored by the NCIBA, and a novel named by the Washington Post as one of the 50 best books of 2019. Laskar's work has garnered praise in Booklist, Chicago Review of Books, The Guardian, and elsewhere. She holds an MFA from Columbia University and an MA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She has books of poetry and prose available for your delectation. A native of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, she now lives in California with her family. Today, we are so pleased to hear her talk about and read from The Atlas of Reds and Blues.
Debbie's book is about a Bengali American woman who has lived a life of racist interactions, and one day, her home is raided and she is shot by the police. She lay bleeding in the driveway, and this is how we hear her story. We really are looking forward to discussing this book with her.
How are you feeling today, Debbie?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. We are so looking forward to talking about your work and really excited you'll read a 10 to 15 minute excerpt for us today. Do you enjoy giving live readings? Is that something you like?
I actually love to read. I'm a poet, and so I'm not afraid of getting up there and speaking aloud. So I'm actually really looking forward to this.
Wonderful.
How does this book fit into your author trajectory, Debbie? Can you talk about how it connects to the rest of your art, your poetry, your other prose, your photography?
Well, you know, I didn't think that I was ever going to write this book again. This book started in 2004 as a short story. So, truth be told, I had been accepted to the Community of Writers Workshop in Squaw Valley, California in 2004, and I was going to use a short story I had written several years before for graduate school about arranged marriage, and I was going to slide that puppy in and be on my merry way. My graduate school roommate, she heard of my plans and said, absolutely not. You will not do this. You must write something new. So it's completely her fault I have this book. And at that time, I was, you know, busy with the kiddos who were very small and my dog. And I said, well, all I'm doing right now is taking care of the kids and the dog. And she's like, great, write about that. So I am a huge fan of Sandra Cisneros. She is a poet who's also written prose, and she had come out with a book called The House on Mango Street.
Oh, we all know that.
No, I love that.
I love that book, right? It's such
I love Men in Hollering Creek, too. Do you love that one? Isn't that one of her next collection?
That's one of her collections, too. So if you look at The House on Mango Street, you put all the beautiful pieces together, it forms this short novel. But if you take all the pieces apart, you'll notice that a lot of them are heavily anthologized in poetry anthologies. And so I wanted to write a story like that. So I wrote a 5,000-word short story for Squaw Valley that year, and it was well received. And so I went home and I made it much bigger, right? So it was now this huge story, very long, very big, lots of voices, crowding everything, but it was a family story. And then I set it aside in 2009 to do NaNoWriMo, which is a National Novel Writing Month, right? That's when...
You're speaking to the choir here. We know these terms. No
worries. Yeah. And so I set it aside to do NaNoWriMo, which I did a ethnic satirical retelling of Mrs. Dalloway. And so 6 weeks before that book was finished, unfortunately, my husband was targeted by, racially profiled by his former employer in Georgia. And so our house was raided and I was raided at gunpoint. So, you know, it was a surprise. I did not know they were coming. Luckily, I had just dropped the children off at school. And among the things that they confiscated were our computers. So I lost the bulk of my work.
Oh my gosh.
And this is horrifying. Was this before, like, did you have any Dropbox, any cloud storage, anything like that?
So yes, we were actually cloud users in the sense that we had the cloud. Not that we ever used the cloud at that point.
You were telling me this terrible story and I'm like, but where did your work go? Is that terrible? You're a writer when?
So, you know, I mean, we had it all set up and so it would, you know, automatically save every month or so. And so I was literally like 2 days away from it being saved again. So I lost most of my work, basically.
Oh my goodness.
So that was tough. So you can imagine the first year after that, we were not doing, I was not doing much of writing. I was busy corralling my family. And then in June of 2011, I sat down to write because I was like, well, you know, I'm a writer and need to write. I found that I could not write. I was unable. I was in turmoil. And so I have a very good friend in Atlanta and she knew I was a photographer. And so she did two things. She made me watch Julie and Julia, which is wonderful because it's about a food writer who gives herself a constraint. She has to do something really big, but in a year. So she has to kind of stay on top of it. And so my friend Robin said, well, why don't you post a picture every day and we'll keep you honest, you know, and then why don't you caption the picture every day? And I promise you, your words will come back if you do it every day. And she was right. It took about a year and I was able to get my poetry back after a year. So I started on June 23rd, 2011, and I do it to this day. And it did take a year to get my poems back. And then it took another 3 years to get my prose back. And so in 2014, wow. 10 years after I had first started writing this short story, I came back to this family and I didn't have much. I had a few pieces that I had emailed a friend, but what pieces I did have left were not of interest to me because I had changed as a person in the intervening 4 years, and I had also changed as a writer, and my focus was very different, and I was no longer interested in just this family story. I was really now interested in how it intersected with the America that was emerging, you know, and so I really wanted to explore this family through a different lens, and so I sat down in 2014, and I finished this book basically right around the time of the election, right before the election.
What an interesting time.
Yes, yes. And then all the stuff with my husband, it was resolved. A state judge in Georgia dismissed all the charges and everything. Literally, we were free the day before the election. And so as you can imagine, we had 24 hours where we were like, oh, this is what this feels like. This is great. And we're going to just march off into the sunset. And then the election happened. And yeah. And then, you know, what happened was for the next year, I tried really hard to sell this book and nobody wanted it. And I can't imagine why, because people were really distracted by what was happening. And I just could not sell this book to save my life.
Did you have an agent at that point?
I couldn't get an agent. I couldn't find a publisher. Nobody wanted this book. I mean, I got the nicest rejections and I also got the cruelest rejections, you know, like, you know, people were like, you know, you're a pretty good writer, but why are you writing about this, you know, or, you know,
what finally moved the needle a little bit and how were you able to get an agent?
Oh, well, I'm going to tell you this story really fast because I did it backwards and I don't actually recommend this for anyone. I had a very good friend whose book came out. And so I went to support her at her reading. And this woman who I only knew to be a poet, but I didn't know anything else about her. She remembered that I had written this book. And so she asked me what the status was. And I said, oh, nobody wants this book. I'm moving on. And she's like, oh, well, she's like, I would love to read your book. And I said, well, you know, I'm a writer. Just if anybody wants to read your work, you don't stop for the coffee to cool, right? You're like, yeah, let me get the coffee right now, right? And to you this minute. And then she was like, oh, I'm an older person. I don't read anything on a tablet or phone. You need to print it out. And here's my address. And you need to mail it to me. So I'm like, wow. Yes, ma'am, I'm going to do that. So I get home. My printer is finish this sentence, dead. And so I call the copy store and I send them my file and then I send it off to her. And this is Veterans Day, November of 2017. And so I don't hear from her at Thanksgiving. I don't hear from her at Christmas. And I'm like, okay, she hates it. She's trying to figure out how to tell me. And I'm on the East Coast visiting my family on New Year's Eve when I get an email and she's like, loved your book. Can I show it to a friend? And I'm like, sure. And so then 10 days go by. Meanwhile, I am a bit of a professional student and I've gone to Mexico with my pen and my pad of paper to do a poetry workshop. And I have my phone, but that's it. I have no other device. And then 10 days go by. She emails me again. She goes, hi, someone at Counterpoint Press would like to read this book. And I was like, that's great. And they're like, but they refused to read the hard copy. Can you send them an electronic copy? And I'm just sitting there going, what? And I'm literally standing in this courtyard in Tepoztlan, Mexico, looking at my phone going, well, I better figure this out because this offer will go away if I don't take care of it right now. And so I'm just standing there. And then I suddenly remember the copy store. So I called them from Mexico.
Oh, no.
And I was like, hey, how's it going? And they're like, great. And I'm like, you don't happen to have my electronic file still, do you? And they're like, well, yes, this is the last car we still do by some miracle. And I'm like, great. Can you send it back to me? And so they did. And then I sent it off to Counterpoint. And then another 10 days go by. And now it is the 1 year anniversary of the inauguration, and I am trying to re-enter the United States from Mexico. And, you know, I'm a little worried, but I get in, it's fine. And then when I am able to turn my phone back on again, I have a message and it says from Counterpoint, and it says, hey, why did you write this book? Can you give us some context? And I'm like, okay. And luckily by then the New York Times had picked up the story about my husband and I was able to share that with them. And I was able to share, you know, some of the information that I had gathered over the years as a former reporter. And then another 10 days go by and I get a phone call and they basically ask me a bunch of questions. And then they call me back 8 hours later and they say, you need to go get an agent this weekend because we're making you an offer on Monday. And so I,
you know. It's cool to give you the opportunity to go get an agent, though.
Yeah.
And I mean, protect yourself, kind of.
That was really quite kind of them. And, you know, I'm an older debut author, so I know more people, right? And so I literally went to my grad school roommate, who's the one who made me write the story in the first place. And I was like, okay, I need an agent. And she was like, well, what do you want? And I said, I want someone who's super nice, but knows her job, because I'm too old to be fighting with people. And I see people all around me who have adversarial relationships with their editor and their agent. And that is not for me. And so she did. She found me the most wonderful agent. And then my editor at Counterpoint is the most wonderful person.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. So You know,
I bet that the fact that you had a publisher in hand made it a lot easier to get an agent to go, oh, okay, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, I feel really comfortable that my agent, her name is Reiko Davis. She's wonderful. She's great, really great agent. But I feel really comfortable that Reiko, I mean, she's a very honest person. If she didn't like the book, I think she would have told me. So, you know, I really lucked out. I got two people who it's been such a pleasure to work with. And I know that my story is so atypical because I do see so many of my colleagues who are struggling in that arena. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in the photography element you were talking about. So I'd like to return there for just a second.
Sure.
Because I was reading this article and I know that the naming of photographs was a way that you used to kind of re-enter the written work from what you were saying also after the kind of traumatic autobiographical events of this novel story happened. And it struck me that it seems like often when an author or creative person is in the process of recovery from a traumatic event, there are many small moments, many steps sort of in a return to the recreation of self or identity. Did you feel like, I mean, I'm sure it felt really great to sell this book, but in the process of working on this book and writing it, did you feel like even though you may have felt it had doomed prospects right before you sold it, did you feel like working on it helped with that kind of return to wholeness as you were working your way through creating this narrative?
I think you're actually talking about the C word, catharsis.
Mm.
And I don't believe in catharsis. I will be the first one to tell you that writing this book did not make me feel better. What made me feel better was that I was able to write.
Just the act of writing.
Yes, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do that again. So,
yeah, I mean, you were like, you were going to get rid of it. You were going to give up on it right before this thing happened. So you weren't ready to champion it.
I was ready to chuck it and move on. So I am very grateful that I was able to write and I was able to communicate how I've changed as a writer and what my interests are. But writing this book did not make me feel one bit better about what happened, because nothing I will ever do is going to make me feel better about that.
Do you ever feel like when you go read from it in public, at a certain point, I feel like I was promoting like 4 books back to back, reading from them, and they had a lot of content that was really upsetting to me. Obviously, I was writing my way through it. And I felt like I was almost reharming myself every time I would have to go read to promote this book. And then people would be like, "This is so beautiful." And you'd be like, "Yeah, my tongue was dripping blood. Hi, thanks." That way? I mean, I'm just curious. I might be the only one. It's cool. Tell me if I'm the only one.
Sometimes people ask me how I'm doing, you know, right after I've read or something. But, you know, I gave this character some of me, but that character isn't me. And so, you know, one of my profs at Columbia, she knew Grace Paley really well. She was friends with her.
Wow.
And Grace Paley used to say to her, you know, "You're not supposed to write about what you know. You're supposed to write about what you don't know about what you know." Right? So you're supposed to explore what you think you know and what you don't know about a situation that's familiar to you. And so I gave my character some of me, right? I gave her the raid. And I'll tell you why about that in a second. But I gave her, you know, my kids and my dog. But then the rest of it's not me. I used to be a reporter.
It's like a country song. They got the kids and the dog.
Right? And I gave her my setting. It was Atlanta, right? But I didn't. The rest of it's just a composite of all of my observations as a reporter and a woman of color in the South. And, some of the episodes are definitely, you know, things that are composite from what I've observed among my friends in Pearsett, also people of color in the South. And I was interested in writing that intersection of a family of color in the South as it intersects with racism and misogyny and being treated as other, right? I think that you had asked me a question earlier and I've completely...
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the structure, Debbie, if you don't mind talking about that, because I was really interested in the way the book is comprised of smaller sections that alternate between the past and the present. There's this kaleidoscope of experience. The lens shifts from near to far. And also, I love the ellipses you use in the beginning and the ampersands. And I wanted to... you to talk to us a little bit about the process and structuring the book.
Oh, that's a good question. So, you know, in improv, people do and, right?
Mm-hmm.
This and this and this, and then this happened, right? You sort of take what you've done already and you accumulate, right? So that's what the ampersands are for. Right.
That's kind of humorous, right? So you were actually being a little bit tongue in cheek as you would throw an and in there sometimes. I felt that between certain sections.
Yes, right. Because it's sort of, and I gave my main character synesthesia, which is a true life condition where she hears something or smells something and she sees a color. And in this case, she sees reds and blues. So, you know, she's been shot. She's lying on the driveway. She's not getting up and having conversations with people. So that was my avenue of trying to get her to tell her story. I have a longstanding writing group, and one of my colleagues is a screenwriter. And so Aristotle's incline is the structure. And I used that structure because it was appropriate for my character, because this is how she's going to get to tell her story, by lying on the driveway and hearing what is going around her and seeing bits, seeing a little bit, hearing a little bit, smelling a little bit, and having her free associate, like, oh yeah, I have synesthesia, so this word or this sound is going to make me remember this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I noticed that, like, there was a lot of symbology. There was a lot of incremental repeton. There was a lot of kind of the color aspect was threading its way through in kind of a visual pattern, which is what makes the cover really cool. Actually, I think that was kind of a neat thing. The cover was visually doing something for me in that vein. I wanted to jump in here and just say, I've read in an interview that you love to write pantoums.
Yes.
Which makes a lot of sense when I'm thinking about how I absorbed this narrative. It's kind of like a very long pantoum where you can't see the line breaks.
Thank you. That's the nicest thing someone has ever said to me.
I love it. I write pantoums. I've written in like 50 different poetic forms. I used to do like a poem a day marathon where I would do, okay, today we're going to do a Sestina. Today. We're going to do a heroic crown of sonnets. Okay, today we're going to. For those listeners out there who aren't familiar with poetic forms, the pantoum is a Malaysian form of poetry with refrains that sort of echo through the poem. It's a poetic form comprised of a series of quatrains where the second and fourth lines of each stanza are repeated as the first and third lines of the next. But a lot of repeated lines in the pantoums that reemerge. One of the tricks of being a really amazing poet, or in this case, fiction writer, is that as the idea or line kind of reemerges into the narrative, it has a different meaning based on the context of what's immediately around it. So I was really curious because, of course, I'm noticing the poetic elements as I'm reading this book. Can you explain how the writing of poetry may or may not be really intimately connected to your prose writing, like the importance of repetons in your work, symbols and ideas winding through? Do you think that that's something that's going to be recurrent through your prose?
Yeah. You know, when I came back to this story in 2014, I had to let go of some of my reporter skills. You know, when I was a reporter back in the day, I was, you know, really hooked on accuracy, right? You know, if something happened on a Wednesday at 3 p.m. in my child was wearing, you know, a jumper, then all of those details somehow had to make it in, right? And when I came back in 2014 and I was looking at the story and I was like, no, you know what? That stuff isn't important to me anymore. I want to know the truth of the story and not the details of that led to that story being included. And so I sort of checked the accuracy and really focused on the truth. And also, I've been a reporter, I'm a poet, I've been told so many times to keep it short, right? Uh-huh. And I was looking at Cisneros again, and I was also looking at this book that had come out in 2014, Citizen by Claudia Rankine.
Right. Uh-huh.
He talks about race and racism. And I was like, I'm going to marry the two. I think that if I can write something short that's fast paced and have it discuss something hard like racism, then that's the way to go for me because those are the two things that I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
She's on the driveway bleeding. She doesn't have 500 pages. She has 253 pages because that's all she's got. That's the time she has.
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's so lovely. And what's really interesting is part of the poetry for me in the narrative, in the prose narrative, if this makes any sense of this book, and if I don't make sense, feel free to tell me, but is the white space. The white space is the poem, is the breath between the various things that are going on with the narrator. And so in that way, I was reading this book as a poem as well as a prose narrative.
I remember when I was first putting this book together before Counterpoint Ticket that, you know, I had friends, you know, very well-meaning friends, and they're like, well, is this really a novel? Maybe it's a novella. Maybe it's just a really long short story. I'm like, no, this is, you know, Sandra Cisneros' book is 119 pages. And it's hardly 20,000 words. And mine's 30, at that time, it was 30 something thousand words. And I was like, oh, I think I'm definitely in the realm of a novel. And I'm going to keep calling it a novel because that's what I think it is. And then I remember that a couple of things happened once Counterpoint Ticket. My wonderful editor, Jennifer Alton, she and I had a talk. She's like, well, you know, how do you want to do this visually? Because we could do it the way we've done some other books that have short chapters and just have them come one after each other, but on the same page. And I'm like, if you would like to do that, that's fine. But I also made the case for, I feel like it should be spaced out because I want people to think about it before they move on.
I really like the white space a lot. And I also kept thinking of the idea of it being a map or an atlas of some sort as I was reading it. And I noticed that in your book of poems, Gas and Lodging, No Lodging, and Anastasia Maps, they explore belonging and not belonging, race, culture, dislocation. And the element of maps echoes for me a little bit the idea of the atlas in the title of the book we're talking about today. Can you tell us how maps exist in your way of thinking or how you use them in your writing?
I have always been fascinated with cartography, right? Mm-hmm. I have just always loved finding myself on a map. And, you know, my dad was an academic for many years. And so I had a great privilege when I was growing up of being able to travel with my family and, and see the world and through a child's viewpoint. Right. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, like, you know, every time we would go to some new, he did a sabbatical in Germany one year and I was quite young, but I was the only one in the family that spoke German. And so at the time, and so I just remember, you know, I'm this little 8-year old, the only one who speaks German. And there are some places, some little towns in France and, you know, Germany and Italy where they don't speak English. And so at least I had a chance of, you know, with my German to like order food or get us a hotel room. And, mm-hmm. And so we would always be like poring over the maps, right? And I just have this fond memory of that. But also, you know, this is a story about a woman who has no home. She is not welcome in America, which is the land of her birth. And so she's seeking her place, right? And the title used to be When the Dolls Leave the Dollhouse, which is a nod towards the model minority myth, you know, and how Asians are supposed to be the model minority and we're passive and silent, right? And so Counterpoint really hated that title. And so when they did take the book, we were haggling over the title and they were like, well, we don't like that title. You're a poet, come up with something else. And so once again, I have been a poet at the Community of Writers in California several times. And in 2008, I went and the title of this book comes from an unpublished poem that I wrote in California in 2008. It was my very first overt political poem. And the line is the Atlas of Reds and Blues, where reds mean more than convention and blues are not just songs of regret. And so I've taken all these lines from my poem and I'd stuck them on a page. And because America was not practicing democracy in 2017 and 2018,
nor is it now,
we decided we would practice it a little bit at Counterpoint. So several folks from Counterpoint and several folks from my family all voted for the title. And this was the unanimous choice.
It's a wonderful title. Wow.
Well, so you started writing this book as a story in 2004. Correct me if I get anything wrong. And then it was published in 2019. Mm-hmm. So, but in light of what you're talking about, which hasn't changed, it's only accelerated in its visibility. Has there been more response to it more recently? And what has that response been in light of the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests, all the focus on the police? It seems like it almost presaged or is kind of very topical and excellent to bring up in the context of that conversation.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think several people have commented on that, but, you know, definitely some of the early reviews last year, you know, they kept talking about how this book was set in Trump's America, but
Can I just say gross? This is not Trump's America. It accidentally became his.
Yeah.
I hate him so much. Oh, maybe I shouldn't say that out loud in a podcast.
You can edit yourself out. you know, the fact is that this book is set in 2010 when we had our first African-American president.
Yeah.
And people do not know that. They read the book and they completely forget. And I think that's very interesting.
You know, for me, this book, as I read it, really yanked me into the tiny moments. Like, I mean, I know there was this larger context, but I found that I was caught up a lot of the time, kind of the microaggressions and the sense of just like rejection and loneliness and kind of how horrifying it is to really get deeply into a narrator and realize that they feel like this part of the American dream doesn't belong to you. this thing you're being excluded from. That was what was the most powerful part for me. Did you feel like that was more of a focus for you as you were writing?
You know, I think you make a really good point. You know, I think one of the reasons why probably that irked you, or like more than irked, but really resonated with you, is that you, when you think of racism, right, you're not expecting it at the dry cleaners or at the movie kiosk or at, you know, at the restaurant. you're not expecting it there. You're expecting it on the street. You're expecting it like you would see it in a film, right? Or something big, right? It's like a big thing. But when it's every day, mm-hmm. and in little moments,
the moment of the dry cleaner in the book really was hard to read, because it should have been such a simple transaction. And it was so many layers and levels of racism.
And that is actually the experience mm-hmm. of a lot of people of color in this country. And I know it is so hard to talk about racism. And even now, with all of these things that are going on, it is still so hard to talk about racism, because people feel defensive, people feel attacked. Then the conversation immediately, you know, stops mm-hmm. and or devolves, you know. And so my hope is that people read this book and discuss how maybe the characters in the book are treated and why, and maybe then pull out the lens a little bit and see maybe how in real life this is happening, and then maybe this book will start a conversation.
Right.
This book will help. Well, conversation, right? Because nothing's going to change. No matter what we do, nothing's going to change until we have that really difficult conversation and accountability about what is happening and why and how we can all work together to change.
Right. Without- and ongoing conversations, not just one.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I am so excited to hear you read from this book today, and we're ready. But before we do that, let's have Ram tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book, and it is delicious. I am having it right now. so let's have Ram tell us about the cocktail, and then let's get to it and hear.
Well, the cocktail is called Red Doll Blues, and we've been talking so much, and I've been enjoying the conversation. We didn't get to talk as much about the colors or the doll, the symbol of the doll in the story, but it was a pretty star, the Barbie doll as a symbol. So we wanted something that represented that. And so we created a drink with bourbon, pomegranate juice, simple syrup, lemon juice, and a little bit of Prosecco, and we put some blueberries in also. So we've got the red and the blue going there. And those colors really do seem to appear on almost every page of the novel. It's really beautifully done, because as I was reading, then there would be a splash of red somewhere or a bit of blue. So anyway, that's our cocktail for today. And what do you think about it?
Well, I think it sounds great. It's a shame I don't drink. But I guess you'll have to have one for me.
We will have one for you, for sure.
Well, and you know, I promised my daughter that I would make her a virgin version of this cocktail later today.
Oh.
So you can make it a mocktail. Just take that bourbon out. The pomegranate juice is really hopping no matter what.
Yes, I think that's a brilliant idea. I'm going to try this.
Will you tell us about the excerpt that you're going to share with us today?
Sure. So I was thinking, and if you don't like it, I have another thought too, but I was thinking that I would read from towards the end of the book on what happens to the narrator on September 12th.
You know, I absolutely want to hear what you think is most relevant for you to read for us. We're going to be delighted no matter what. So pick what you'd like.
Okay. So yeah, I was interested in this passage just because I think it, unfortunately, we're at a point in our country where, you know, we are in the midst of a pandemic, and we are all struggling. And this is it sort of reminds me of the days right after 9/11.
Okay.
All right, here I go.
Yes.
Groaning machines exhale steam behind him. Hot fog lapping the countertop where canvas bags of dirty laundry wait to be dry cleaned and made anew. Mr. Patel rakes his thin hands through his thinning hair. They look around the rest of the shop, broken glass underfoot and glistening in the midday sun. September 12th. Despite the floor-to-ceiling American flag broadly displayed in the now-destroyed plate glass window, despite the banner proclaiming God bless America for all to see. They will never pass for American. A broad white man parks his German convertible in the loading and unloading only zone, stomps in, sporting a keg-sized gut and aviator sunglasses. Without hesitation, Mr. Patel greets his customer. Mr. Jackson, thank you for coming. A smile begins its long journey from the lips to the cheeks. Mr. Jackson grunts. My wife said to leave it alone, but I told Missy I had to be ready the next time I got called into work. Mr. Patel turns his back and walks into the fog, disappears. Mr. Jackson stares straight ahead, his right hand jangling his car keys. It sounds like a dinner bell, but it is only noon. He will not look at Mother's face. He will not acknowledge Mother's very pregnant body. Mr. Patel reemerging, with three starched button-down shirts, Oxford blue, and two pairs of khaki trousers pressed sharply as if cut with a knife, all wrapped in plastic. The reflection from the American flag casting a red and white striped sheen over the plastic in everyone's faces. Here you go, sir, he says, his voice calm amid the broken glass. I'll come back later, Mr. Jackson says in lieu of thank you, snatching the hangers from Mr. Patel's hand. Missy's got the checkbook, like she's going to be able to buy anything today. The grocery store in Marietta is open until 2 o'clock, Mother finds herself saying aloud. Mr. Jackson turns toward her. Where are you from? She opens her mouth, but Mr. Jackson rushes in to answer his own question. It doesn't matter. You need to get on home, girl. Mother puts her hand on her distended stomach, the baby kicking. The due date is weeks away and the airports are shut down. She must remain calm and free of labor before grandmother can fly down to help. She cannot have a baby today. She looks over at Mr. Patel, God bless America, reflecting in his watery eyes. She digs the fingers of her free hand into the bundle of keys on the counter and uses the other hand to smooth her pink maternity blouse over her stomach. I am home, she says, as softly as she can. Mr. Patel's head barely shakes a frightened no. Mr. Jackson grunts and walks back to his car, unlocks the trunk using his remote. He lays the plastic enclosed clothes down carefully. Mr. Patel reaches below the counter and places a couple of cheap American flag stickers on the counter near her hand. You need this, he says, pushing it toward her. It'll help. Mr. Jackson closes the trunk and quickly enters his car, presses the gas, and squeals away from the curb, exhaust smoke curling in the air. She pushes them back toward him. Not at my house, she says. Please take it, Mr. Patel says. Just one for you, then. Mother goes home and finds her hero perched on the arm of the couch, unable to stay seated for long, unable to stand for long, his eyes never leaving the screen, the towers in an endless cycle of crumbling and then standing upright as an airplane flies into one of them, and then crumbling again. Mr. Patel says we should put flag stickers on our cars. She takes the sticker out of her handbag. We're American, her hero says, waving her sentence away as if it were a mosquito. She holds it out to him. No one can tell when I'm driving. He stops, sits, stands up. I'm not going to, he says. You don't have to, she whispers, tucks the sticker back into her bag, and points at his dirty blonde hair turning gray. But I have to. He punches the throw pillow, blue with tiny red flowers embroidered at the edges, with his tight fist. You shouldn't have to prove anything, her hero says. This is not the America I know. This is not the America I recognize. The baby kicks. She looks at the screen after the towers have crumbled, survivors covered in white ash and dust walking away, and she touches her stomach. That's it.
Wow. Thank you for reading that.
Thank you.
That was so beautiful. I mean, I want more. Can we have another little excerpt? I feel like another touch of this book would be great.
Okay, sure.
I can tell you two pages that I would love to hear if you would take the request.
Please.
I really love everything that leads up on page 63, and I love page 64 in particular. If you could read that excerpt, it would be really lovely for me.
Sure. 63 and 64?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do it.
Is it weird that I pick a little section that I wanted to hear articulated?
No, it's not at all. It's not at all. Perhaps it is the last day she is a resident of Manhattan. 2 glorious years in New York, graduate school, she and Emily and Lydia practically inseparable. She leaves the last 2 boxes of books, poetry, biography, some novels, a coffee table book on the history of art, on this doorstep of another classmate, Sarah, who is lucky to live near the Seinfeld Diner year-round. Emily waits at the nearby coffee house for the final goodbye to cement the promise that they'd always be sisters, that they'd stay in touch. Her flight to California is later that night. Lydia is leaving the following day for Chicago, and she is heading to Georgia with the official designation as trailing spouse. The real thing walks into the shop and finds Emily alone at the table set for 3. Where's Lai? Emily grimaces. She couldn't stay. What? She's not going to say goodbye? Not everyone is good at goodbye, Emily says. Not everyone is as practiced as you. Years later, after she moves them from the city to homogenous suburbia, cookie-cutter identical for everyone but her, no one answers their doors when mother and daughters walk march up and down the cul-de-sac and ring the doorbells, homemade brownies in hand. Not only do the new neighbors not come over to see if they are all right after the lightning strikes the new house, none of them bother to say welcome. No chicken casseroles forthcoming, no chocolate chip or oatmeal cookies, no smiles. They, the family, wait patiently every day, like maiden aunts at a charity dance, waiting to be asked to waltz. No one calls.
Oh, God. You know, those 2 passages back to back, they just gut me. They gut me because I think that it's just the juxtaposition of you have these kind of anglicized sounding names, these people she's in this college environment with, all of this literature, all of these books, this very tight kind of trio of friends, and this feeling of being left at the altar by one of them, sort of, who doesn't show up for the goodbye. And then the absolute horror of being not even having this horrible thing responded to by this community. I mean, is that why you pick those 2 sections right next to each other?
So, you know, I'm going to tell you a quick story about the order of this book. So when I was in graduate school, I had the great privilege and pleasure of working with Lucille Clifton.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Lucky you.
I was very lucky. And so she was a fantastic teacher, but she was also a really good friend to me. And one of the things that Lucille was a really big believer in is oral tradition, right? So she's a big believer in, you know, telling our stories aloud and repeating our stories until somebody else can grab it and then carry it forward. Right. And so, you know, Lucille passed in 2010. And so, but I remember that she would always make us read our work out loud. And so after Counterpoint took the book and I was in the editing process, I read this book out loud to myself twice. And 2 things happened. There are a couple of places where I stumbled as I was reading. And, you know, Lucille used to say that when your tongue trips, it's just an indication you'd have incorrect phrasing or you have incorrect word choice, right?
Yeah.
So there are a couple of places where I, you know, fixed the words. But then a couple of things happened also, which I think was much more important, was that as I was reading it out loud to myself, I realized that there were a couple of things that were out of order. And so I had an opportunity there to change it. I was like, oh, my main character wouldn't think of this before this, right? Or you know, I had to change the order. And so one of the reasons why those 2 passages went side by side is because that's the order of reflection of the narrator, right? Mm-hmm. So she had a natural, she remembered one thing and it led to the memory of the other thing. And that's how I did the entire book, was I just had her go, well, as I was reading it aloud, I was like, well, okay, she's thinking of this and then she hears this. And then what is the next thing she's going to think of? And there were just a few places, but I had to switch things around. And so that's why it is in the order that it is.
That's so interesting.
I wouldn't have had it in the correct order if I hadn't have read it out loud to myself.
Well, that's interesting because I think when people read out loud, they think about finding the micro and not the macro. And you're finding like an order change to make when you're reading it out loud is really interesting. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask a question. I think Heather has one more question, and then we're going to let you go. I wanted to ask, what do you think is the most important thing for women writing literary fiction that they can do to gain legitimacy or visibility for their work?
I think that's such a great question. You know, I think we have a chance to lead by example, right? Which is, I feel like I have a really strong community, and it's because we cheer each other on and we offer constructive criticism to each other and we lift each other up, mm-hmm. right? I can't do this alone. And also, I take my writing seriously, and my peer set does the same. And so when you take your writing seriously and you make space for your writing and you don't apologize for your work, it seeps out into the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the more we can help other women and people of color get to the table, right? And so that we can have a discussion about why the publishing industry, for example, is still 84% white. And the more we can include new voices and act as though we are one community, then we will become one community of people.
Yeah, and I think it's very, I just want to add in here that this is so important what you're saying. It's really important to choose deliberately, to pick toward diversity, to be really inclusive and supportive of those voices. I was just listening to a talk at, I think it was Literary Cleveland last week or something, and they were saying basically that people of color enter into the stream of the publishing field as interns, get no support, and often fall out. And I thought that that was one of the larger issues, is that it's not just how many people of color are in the publishing industry, it's at what level, making which decisions.
Right. Right. And I feel like, you know, the more we can support each other and cheer each other on and provide, you know, whatever connections we have, you know, to help, you know, give the next person down the line. You know, I don't feel like I'm in competition with anyone. If anything, the only thing I'm in competition with is the clock, right?
Right.
You know, I was a debut novelist at 52. And so, you know, and now I'm almost 54. And so, you know, I just feel like, you know, I need to do, so many people help me, you know, I think, you know, tongue in cheek, but I think a full third of my book is the acknowledgments page, because I was, you know, so many people helped me over the years. And so I want to return the favor.
Sense of community.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing too, is like, yeah, maybe you were a debut novelist in your 50s, but you know what, obviously from the duration of the work that you had been doing, from your writing of poetry, from your lifelong immersion, you didn't start being a writer then. You know, you were a writer much, much longer, it seems to me.
Right. And as many people, I mean, you know, many people over the years had, you know, told me to quit, right?
Because, oh, no.
Yeah, right. But just as many people have cheered me on. And so I want to be that voice where, yes, you can do it. Establish a writing practice, write every day, you know, every opportunity that you get, take it, you know, or at least. Right.
So before we close today, I just want to check in with you, because I'm excited to kind of follow you and moving forward, because I really enjoyed your book and I'm looking forward to checking out your poetry. What is your next project, and what are you hoping for in the next 12 months? I mean, in terms of your work and what your next big focus is.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you. So I have returned to the book that I lost on the day of the raid. It is the retelling of Mrs. Dalloway, but it is no longer funny. So it might be satirical. I'm not really sure, but it's not really trying to be comedic in this way that I was earlier. But in the meantime, I have actually just finished a very short novel that's second person. So it's you. And so a classmate of mine from grad school, Julie Otsuka, wrote this wonderful book a few years ago called The Buddha in the Attic. And that was first person plural. So it was we. And so I really loved her book. And I was like, well, I can't do we, because I think I don't know how to do that one yet. But I want to try you.
You is pretty fascinating.
And so I love you. Mm-hmm. You're good. And so I wrote a book about where the main character is the you. And so I'm sort of finishing that one up, and then I'm going to go back to my retelling of Mrs. Dalloway. And I just hope I'm, you know, in this age of COVID, I realize that people are having a really hard time. And I am too, you know, I'm not alone. And I think that we should just keep our expectations low. My expectation every day is that I write one sentence.
Wow.
So yeah. Anything above that is ice cream and cake, and I'm grateful.
And, I think that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. And, you know, by writing just one sentence a day as the expectation, then I am actually able to inch forward because I don't have these big plans, you know, like, oh, I'm going to finish the book today, or, you know, I'm going to write a chapter. I'm like, nope, just going to write that one sentence. And whatever comes after that is, you know, it's gravy. Right. And,
right. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really, really love talking to you and hearing you read your book. It was wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Yeah. So everybody out there, go get Debbie's book and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales, Readings, and Drinks for this podcast series. Also subscribe to this podcast because I cannot even tell you how many amazing authors we have coming up. The podcast releases once a month. Come back for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks for joining us today. See you next time.